If there's a community you want to impact, you have to start by talking to them and asking them what their problems are before you jump into designing solutions. Like, whatever idea you have, instead of making the perfect plan to execute it, just like do it. Like, actually go out there and do it and iterate and make it better with time.
Welcome back to the Slow Dive Podcast, where we explore creativity, community, and the courage it takes to imagine a better world. I'm your host, Farida Rafiq, and today we're diving into a conversation about innovation, leadership, and the power of imagination, especially when it's fueled by empathy and purpose. Our guest today is someone who embodies all of that. She's a social entrepreneur, an educator, and a community builder, learning designer who has dedicated her work to empowering young changemakers across borders. Meet Iza Navid, the inaugural Siegel Innovation Fellow and the founder of the Imagination Lab, a social entrepreneurship program supporting immigrant high school students in Massachusetts. She's also the creator of the Young Leaders Program in partnership with Iran and Pakistan, a free fellowship that has trained more than 900 students to become local changemakers through social learning, leadership, and technical skills. Iza is a Global Social Impact House 2024 Fellow through the University of Pennsylvania and an Oval Office Fellow 2024 at Harvard Kennedy School. She holds a Master's of Education from Harvard University and a Bachelor of Science in Cognition, Brain, and Behavior from Minerva University, a program that took her across four continents and five countries. Today, she serves as School Community Outreach Lead and Learning Designer at Half the Story, a nonprofit focused on digital well-being for young people. When she's not mentoring students, you can find her rollerblading, biking, or writing poetry that celebrates connection and courage. So take a deep breath, settle in, and join us as we slow down with Iza Navid to talk about imagination, impact, the art of building communities that help us all thrive. Welcome, Iza.
Thank you so much for having me, Farida. It's such an honor to be here and to get to share my story with your audience today.
No, thank you. I think this is going to be a really great episode because you're just doing such wonderful things. So we're just going to start off with our icebreaker question. What is one thing that is bringing you joy this week?
It's a beautiful and very timely question. My mom is visiting me from Pakistan. She lands in 2 days, and I, before our call, was sitting down and working on an itinerary for her and all the places we're going to see. So I think as adults, we don't get that much opportunity to share pieces of our lives with our parents. And I think it's like a beautiful and rare chance for me to get to do that. Seeing my mom is going to bring me a lot of joy.
That is lovely. Okay, what's one of the places you're going to take her that she hasn't been to? Can you share?
Yes, I think it's called the Filoli Gardens. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that, but it's like a beautiful like castle slash gardens. It's like a 20-minute drive from San Francisco. And my mom like loves nature and she loves historic sites. And I was like, okay, California doesn't have that much historic sites, but there is some. So I'm really excited to take her there.
Nice. If your younger self could see your life today, what would surprise them the most?
It's such a beautiful question. It's interesting because I was at a reunion this weekend for my Global Social Impact House Fellowship, and they asked a similar question about like, look back 10 years from today, like 10 years ago, like where were you? And 10 years ago, you know, and the was like the self that really was thinking about this moment the most. Like I was in high school, I was in Abbottabad, my hometown. I was thinking about moving to Islamabad for my high school. And I had all these questions, ideas, hopes, dreams that were like, completely far-fetched, but I was just still willing to dream and still willing to think about them. It's amazing to say that I've achieved a lot of what Baby Iza wanted to do. And I think Baby Iza would just be like, oh my God, you're so cool. Like you actually made that happen and you did this and you did that. And, you know, and that's a sweet reminder because often we forget our own power. We often forget how far we've come ourselves. So yeah, I think Baby Iza would be like so proud of how far I've come. But thank you for that question.
No. Yeah. And Farida, the podcast host, is also very proud of you. I just met you and I'm like, wow, you've done some great work. And we're now going to share it with our audience. So we're going to start with your origin story from Pakistan to the Bay Area. First of all, really, really quickly, what does a learning designer do before we get into your origin? Like, tell us what is a learning designer for people who do not know?
Yes, an awesome question. So a learning designer is an umbrella term for people that are program designers, curriculum developers and writers, and experience designers. So you basically think about, like in my role today, I think about how people learn, how can we make the learning interactive and increase retention and engagement. And then thinking about how I can, like, from the outcomes that I want from a certain experience, sort of go back to, it's like very like almost backward and forward design simultaneously, like thinking about, okay, if I want people to feel a certain way after they engage with this lesson plan, how might I design the activities so that we reach that outcome? So for learning experience designer, which is sort of what I do, is when I host an event, I don't just like gather people and, you know, bring pasta to the table and I'm like, okay, eat food, like have fun. I think about questions I can ask my friends. I think about, you know, what can I share with them to help them prepare? What can I do in terms of prompting them to help them arrive to the day and to the moment and rise to like what's in front of them? So it's really thinking about outcomes and feelings that you want and then using different methodologies, frameworks, and research to inform what that experience can unfold and look like.
Wonderful. That is a very important job. Okay, Ezza, the word you use is happenstance, but you have a very inspiring journey from Northern Pakistan to San Francisco. Can you share what initially set you on that path? I know we were talking about babies at 10 years ago, but talk mm-hmm. about like what the role of synchronicity and happenstance was for you to now.
Yeah. So this might sound cliche, but there's like a few like quotes that like come to my mind as I think about mm-hmm. my journey. Like one is, well, the word happenstance for sure, but it's the, you can only make sense of a journey. We can only connect the dots backward, not forwards, by Steve Jobs, which is something that a mentor actually said to me 10 and a half years ago, almost at this point. So I grew up in Aptabad. It's you know, it's like increasing in size and population as a city today. But while growing up, it was a very small town, very culturally minded. I had no women in my family that were working, even though they were so brilliant and had great dreams. And I come from a family that does value education a lot. So my grandfather was a psychiatrist, one of the first in Pakistan. My father, my uncle, my brother and sister, they're all psychiatrists. And so like education and pursuit was something that was valued. At the same time, like me and my sister, we didn't have female role models to look up to. It was just us and our dreams and our mom pushing us and encouraging us to talk to different people and get direction and guidance. And so when I was in high school, in Pakistan, we say O levels, like, because it's sliced into O levels, which is 9th and 10th grade almost, and A levels, which is like your last 2 years of high school. For O levels, I was in Aptabad, and I don't know what I wanted, but my best friend Kirat was like, hey, you know, I found out somewhere, Ezza, that if you have great grades, you can get a scholarship to study abroad. And so person I know is doing that. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah, they covered, you know, his whole tuition and so forth. Maybe we should do really well in school so that we are able to achieve those scholarships or like be able to access those opportunities. And that's really why I was like in O-levels, okay, I'm going to do well in school. And when O-levels was ending, there was this one senior I had, she was a few years above me that, you know, left Aptabad to go to Islamabad because she was like, if you want to pursue a better opportunity, you need to be willing to uproot yourself and locate to somewhere where there's like a higher concentration of opportunity and guidance. Mm-hmm. And she was under the belief that, and I really agreed with her that, you know, our small town was still very young. The A-levels program or the senior high school guidance was like very nascent. And she's like, I don't want to play this gamble with my future, but I do want to play the gamble of moving to Islamabad and seeing what opportunities I get there. Without even thinking about it, I told my parents, like, yeah, I think I should move to Islamabad. And they're like, but there's no boarding. Like, the school is designed for like day scholars or like kids that have their families in the city. And I was like, I don't care. Like, I think this is what I should do. I ended up there not really knowing what to expect. And it was two of the hardest years of my life. I had no idea what I'm doing. I was working hard to become a doctor. And this one fine, like Tuesday, or so, it was just like a random day, I was ranting to my high school counselor being like, you know, I gave the SATs like you recommended, but I didn't really want to. I don't think standardized testing is for me, like blah, blah, blah. Like, I just wish I could travel because I really think learning happens outside the classroom and not inside the four walls of a classroom. And his name's Raja Feroz, my bless his soul, like my teacher. He goes, oh, Iza, like, if this is the way you think and you're really frustrated by how, if you really do believe this, you should apply to this university called Minerva. But they have only like a 2% acceptance rate or something bizarre like that. So he's like, just keep it as like as one university, but have some backup options. And, you know, the funny thing is, Farida, like, he wasn't the mentor I worked with on my college applications. Mm-hmm. It was this person, Fariha Yusuf. But Sir Raja Feroz was this person that like just happened to be there in the playground when I was so frustrated and thinking about my future. Yeah, long story short, got into Minerva, packed my bags in August 2017, showed up to San Francisco as a freshman with wide eyes and fear and hope and dreams and all these things at once. But really, like, I think had I not made the almost blind, like, if I know now what I, like, if I knew back then what I know now about how hard it was to live by myself in Islamabad, I don't think I would like move. Like, I would just be like, oh, this is too uncomfortable. But that like leap of faith in the dark almost to be like, yeah, I will land on my feet, like, really helped me.
Yeah, that's like the fearlessness of the hero's journey, the beginner's journey. If you don't know, you don't know anything, right? You're just so open to learning. So you do dive in. And yes, yes. And that was serendipitous for you. So Minerva, how was that experience for you? And I know that was like the genesis that brought you back to this amazing program that you started in Pakistan, which is called Iran. So how did those two connect?
Yeah. I love Minerva. I always tell people, like, I swear they're not paying me for talking about them, though they should, because
they should. Yeah. They should sponsor your podcast, Iza, or your next book or something. They should do that for sure.
But Minerva was just such, like, it was very hard, very formative, but such an amazing experience. Like, you know, I got to spend 4 years, like each semester, living in a new country. So I lived in San Francisco, USA, Seoul, South Korea, Berlin in Germany, Buenos Aires in Argentina, and London in the UK. And when you're in like late teens, early 20s, and the sky is the literal like limit, like, it was just such an amazing opportunity that was given to me that I'm so grateful for. But I think something that's like less known or talked about at Minerva is how much professors and educators care and how they really modeled for me what education should be and can be. Like, our professors would like, they really like go out of their way to like get to know us, like ask us questions, and be part of our journey. Like, to give you an example, I can still email my undergrad advisor, Scott Weiser was his name, and ask him for anything. And he will always respond with a resource or a person that can help me out or jump on a call. And I graduated like 5 years ago.
Amazing.
And so, you know, the beauty of being in a program that teaches you all these skills is you unintentionally take it for granted, or at least in my case, I just thought this is the norm that everyone has. And so I moved to Pakistan a year after Minerva ended. I was working in fintech in San Francisco, had, you know, like was earning well, had a good life. I moved back home to Abbottabad after my H-1B didn't go through the first time. You know, and I meet up with my friend, and my friend Hamad Lodi was running the program Uran. And, you know, I knew him for many years. We both like care about social impact work. And I always thought like, okay, I want to do something for the program, but I never had like a year to live in Pakistan and actually make like tangible impact. And when I started meeting students through that, and when I started meeting and talking to my cousins, family, and like students in my hometown, I just realized, oh my God, the opportunities that I had access to and what all of these kids have access to is like, it's like the sun and the earth. Like they're so far apart that there was almost no comparison. And I think the thing that bothered me the most for me, that was like, I didn't do anything to be born in a home with the parents I had, who invested in my education, were financially able to send me to a good school, gave me a stable enough home, like all of these things, right? These kids, they didn't do anything to deserve the hard life or the challenges that they had. And I think like that was a moment where I was just like, this can't, I'm not under my watch, like no way, you know? So I talked to Hamad Bhai and or my friend Hamad, and I was like, I want to do something here. And he's like, oh, come do like a one-off lecture. I was like, no, I want to make a curriculum. That's when I was like, now I know I was like going into the learning design work back then. So YLP was born, and Young Leaders Program is the initiative that partners with Uran. And through this, we've taught soft skills and, you know, like self-advocacy, like leadership, like collaboration, all these like skills that you need to really thrive in the workplace that Pakistani universities and high schools do not teach. Unless you like pay a really premium price to go to your school, like you don't get access to these opportunities. And we've trained more than 900 students over the last 3 years in developing like these really important and tangible like soft skills.
Tell me, I know we discussed this earlier, but what are some standout stories from your time at Uran that your pay it forward moment, or where you saw the work of the program really flourishing? Is there any examples of that you can share with us?
Yeah, quite a few. I think the one that really stands out to me is this girl, Habiba. Habiba has 6 other siblings. She has many sisters and some brothers. Everyone in her family, like her dad was the most educated person in their family, and he only studied until 7th grade. Mom never went to school. Habiba and her sisters worked as the word that like domestic laborers or domestic help in people's houses in Pakistan. And, you know, it was very common in her family for her parents to like uproot the kids, send them to people's house to earn money and discontinue their education as early as 12. So when I met Habiba first time, she was like maybe 12 or 13 working as a domestic help. For all she knew, like her future was like when she's 16, she was gonna get married to this guy that she was already promised to. And like, you know, financially depend on him and like reproduce and like all these things that are what's traditionally expected of girls in most of rural Pakistan. Habiba came to us when she was on a gap year. Like she pushed herself enough to be in 10th grade, but like that's when she was like, okay, this is the furthest I can go. And she's on a gap year and was very depressed and was like, I mean, she didn't know it was a gap year, right? In her head, it was like the end of her schooling. And she's like, I feel like I could tell that she really wanted a supportive environment and community. but she didn't know how, she didn't know what. Like, there's this thing we say in the world of education called hidden curriculum. It's like the unset norms of a place where, you know, when you don't even know what you don't know, Farida, how can you get step forward? Like, she doesn't know how to like recheck her exam. She doesn't know that's even a concept, right? And so she got bad grades and she's just sitting with them in 10th grade. But she joined VILP, she joined Oran, she did the 2-month program from like 9 to 5 boot camp. And she did an additional 2 months to like really build up her graphic designing skills. She went on to do 11th grade, 12th grade. She's actually now seeking admission in college, which I'm so proud of her. And she worked part-time as a graphic designer. So she actually works with a local like marketing studio in Aptabad and, you know, like is paid monthly and uses that money to financially support her family and pull her siblings through school. Her siblings, like some of them had left school, but now they're like all back in school, thanks to her. And I mean, she's such an amazing girl because like, and one story that comes to mind is, you know, when she was done with VILP, like, she's like, I really want to, like, I really want to work from home or like do my laptop work from home. Like, I've seen like so-and-so friend does it in VILP. How can I do that? And I was like, oh, like you just need Wi-Fi. But we realized that the internet doesn't really reach very easily to her village or her town outside the city of Aptabad. So we actually got her a Wi-Fi egg thanks to a generous donation. And the deal was that she had 7 months of this internet access to find herself an opportunity that can self-sustain her. Two months in, she had something. And she reinvested the rest of the stipend that was given to her for her like family and like her siblings, so they don't have to like do domestic work. And I think the thing that's so amazing is like, I think often change makers have this, like sometimes have this false perception that, Farida, I am only going to invest in you when you prove yourself to me. Whereas I think my perspective is I will believe in you completely. And because of my belief, you are going to rise to the vision I hold of you. And I noticed that over and over again with my students in VILP. Like, I had a 29-year-old who had never touched a computer in his life. And part of VILP was like, he had to, all the students had to go to their communities. It could be anyone, their family, the street, like, you know, boys in the hostel they're staying in, and talk about and explain concepts from what they were learning and what they had gained. So to continue that chain of knowledge sharing. And it was amazing. Like, I had to give all my students feedback. So he does his presentation in class about how he taught the boys in his hostel. And it was amazing. And on one of the slides, I was like, oh, like you had these typos, it might help you to proofread this. And he's like, ma'am, like, thank you, but this is the first, like, I didn't know how to use a computer. Like, 5 weeks ago, I like opened a computer for the first time and learned to type. Like, this is the first time I'm using Microsoft Suite to make a PowerPoint. Like, learning PowerPoint took me 10 hours, you know? And it's like, and so like, he's like, so I know there's a typo, but it's okay, you know? And I think that was like such a moment for me to be like, that's right. I can't, like we say in Urdu, nukta chini, like I can't like go with a fine tooth comb every single moment and forget like the broad strokes of their growth.
How was it received? How has that been received in the community? How many stories are there like this of people, of younger and older students upskilling and learning and getting into the curriculum? Like, how has it been received and where is it now currently?
It's been received so well. My students were so sad when I was leaving Pakistan to do my master's at Harvard, and they were just like, ma'am, like, this isn't fair, like, you know, like, why are you leaving us? And when I go back, like, I'm gonna go back in December to Pakistan, I meet my students. We have alumni dinners. We have alumni lunches. You know, it's informally organized because I'm doing the community engagement myself. So it's like, hey, who's in town? Like, 2 weeks from now, we're going to meet up. And people always come. And I go do the lectures in all the, like, I still go back to our brick and mortar classroom to do like lectures or workshops for the students that are present. So there's like a consistent like touch point with me. But there's so many stories like this, Farida. These are two that I've just shared. Like from the 70 students that I taught myself across two batches, like it's easy to say I had more than 70 stories, right? And part of like what we did a lot of introspective work, because I don't think true change begins without like targeting and talking about the traumas that my students had been through and giving them a space and a container to process that. And the first day they would come, like the prompt was that they would have to write the story of their life on a piece of paper, fold it up, like it should be anonymized, and put it in a box. And we would pass it around and we would all read that story. And when I asked students about their reflections after that story, and I would always say, like, do you have a moment, like, does anybody want to claim the story? And they would add more context. And Frida, when I say I would go home and like cry and cry and cry, and like my therapy sessions were all processing the stories of my students, like, you know, to make sure I have that support as well. Like there was just so, so much. And it was beautiful to see, like, in the last day reflection, my students, like again, we would do a similar anonymized activity and they would share, like, you know, like one of my students' most touching stories to me was like, they came from a community where, you know, there was a lot of sectarian violence between Shia and Sunni communities. And so just to protect their identity, I'll keep it super high level, but like they lost their community, they lost their home, they lost their father, and they never gave themselves the permission to mourn. And since they were six, they'd just been trying to be like the breadwinner or like being the brave face for their family since they were six. And to have them be like, I finally give myself permission to breathe, to be, like, it's just phenomenal. And like one of my students had this pressure on his shoulders since he left his small village near really like deep KPK students would like come to Ahmedabad and stay there for this program. And I'm so proud of that boy because we had a guest speaker that came and like talked about being a software engineer and how you can train to be one. And he's now a founder. My student ended up reaching out to this person, moved to Islamabad, did like worked with them for a year, and now created his own production house and actually ended up hiring students from Oran and VILP to work with him. And it's just like, you know, we are just a channel. We have, everyone is powerful. People have the compass. We just have to make sure we are providing them the field and the environment to really make their dreams come alive. But my students are brilliant. So, yes.
I see. I can feel the passion you have for your work. And I can feel it. And our audience can probably feel it too. I'm going to ask you, where did the drive and the empathy and the passion to get into this work originate from? You know, social entrepreneurship, did you find yourself in there? But like, how did you figure out this is what I'm doing for the rest of my life? I mean, and also what you said about providing a safe space and a container for people to be seen and be vulnerable. How did you arrive to that place at such a young age, if I may say? Because a lot of people, and I applaud you, because a lot of people get into purpose-driven work later in life. And this is something you're doing from the get-go. So how did that happen? Is that just something you've always had in your heart? Yeah, just curious, because you're obviously doing the work and you're making an impact, but you're quite young, and that's a good thing. But, you know, that's why I ask.
That's so sweet. Thank you, Farida. I think so for the importance of making a container, I wouldn't use those words, right? Like, I know those words now, but I was making a container. I just knew I had to hold space, because I really recommend everyone should go to therapy. Everyone.
Yes.
Even if they're like, I think I'm fine, please go to therapy. And you'll realize you're not 100% fine. But I think my therapy really taught me the importance of showing up that way. And the way Minerva created space for us, like, also was such a good modeling for me about, I didn't realize it, that I didn't go in being like, okay, my professor is doing this and 6 years later, I'm going to do the same thing. Like, but I was absorbing all of this. I think with like where the purpose and passion comes from to give back, I think my family really valued khidmat-e khalq, or it's mm-hmm. Urdu for like service of humanity. My father, may he rest in peace, I lost him right before I moved to Islamabad. He dedicated a lot of his life to social good and social causes. Like, on his funeral, we had so many people that were like, they would say they've been orphaned because my dad was, without our knowledge, like, buying groceries for them, paying tuition for their kids to go through school, funding them to go to college. Like, he did a lot of like social work and charity work without our knowledge, and always in such a way that the other person felt empowered and not as if they were at the mercy of my dad. And I think a lot of like social work in Pakistan can sometimes be misguided because, you know, you take selfies giving packages to the people mm-hmm. you're helping. So I think like that was something that definitely like shaped me a lot. And I think the other thing is like, I had a teacher in high school that like would, in middle school, that would consistently say, the best thing you can do is social work. Like, it's like you giving back to people with what you have is like one of the most noble things. And it was just so ingrained in me. But then also for that, there's so much inequity in Pakistan, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm going in my nice car to my school where it's completely English medium, so I'm learning so much. And there's people that are begging on the side of the street that shouldn't be there, right? I think another thing that, like, I'm just realizing now as you ask this question, is like, my journey as a woman and girl really helped me move from being in the place of, like, I don't know, higher on the pyramid of getting access to opportunity to being pushed to the very bottom in some ways. Like, I saw my journey until middle school, like, I was seen as like a student that's doing well and like student that's this and that. But I saw the shift in middle school to even my teachers referencing to me as a young woman and girl. And I'll never forget, like, a teacher, my best friend, I, Omar, he's a guy, like, We debate, it was a debate competition in like an English class and an Urdu class. Like, so we debated and I was objectively better in the points I made than he was. But the teachers were like, oh, but we want him to be first. And I was like, why? It's like, because his voice carries command, because he's a man.
Wow.
And I was just like, but I'm following the criteria. Like, what is going on? And like, there were a lot of moments like that in my high school journey and beyond where I was just like, because I'm a girl or a woman, like, can't go for a walk, can't go to the gym, can't go for running outside, can't go for a bike ride. All these things that like I couldn't do because I was a girl. And I was like, damn, is this going to be my life? And then moving to San Francisco and then being able to do those things again, and then moving back to Pakistan and being like, there's a new normal. Like, we can't accept the world as is. Like, we can actually do things to change. Because how did these societies end up where they are? Not to say San Francisco is a perfect place, but it's like, it's, I mean, so messed up. But for me as a woman, you know, like, yes. I was like, I can go for a walk. Like, what? By myself? My mind just melted. And when I went back to Pakistan, I was like, I can't go for a walk here yet, but I can do something to change this. And I think that mindset is like what really served me in thinking about, like, for the students, like, they're not there yet. Like, they want to interview at these companies, but they don't even know how yet. Like, it's like inserting that yet, because I'd experienced a new normal, was what really, like, yeah, it really changed the way I thought about it. Thank you for giving me a chance to reflect
on
that.
I've been to Pakistan a few times in the recent years, and Islamabad is so vastly different from the other cities that we were talking about. So to have those experiences for students from rural villages to come to Islamabad and have all that, it's amazing. And I think also there's so much needed there. You know, I don't know My parents were immigrants to America, so I've only gone back just to visit. Do you think there, and this is a, and you don't have, we don't have to keep this in our recording. I'm going to ask this. This wasn't on my script. Do you think that there's only an answer if you feel less comfortable and we don't have to keep it. Do you think there's a lot of younger talent and people leaving Pakistan and staying and coming back and investing back in Pakistan after they go abroad to UK or Canada or America? What is that like? Because obviously there is a need. There is a need for change makers and social innovators and entrepreneurs like yourself to bring back frameworks and blueprints and change things up. So how is that received? I guess the correct question is, are people leaving and coming back to invest permanently, or are they like staying abroad?
Yeah. I mean, that's such a powerful question. And I think everyone will have a different perspective. I think it's really hard to go back and invest. And I think truthfully, even for me, Farida, like, you know, having lost access to my freedom in Pakistan as a young woman, and like in many ways, like, life is objectively not the same. I can't go for a stroll at 10 p.m. in a park in Pakistan. I can't, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I wouldn't have moved back unless I lost my H-1B as well. Or like, if I won that lottery, I would have probably stayed. Maybe I would have moved back, but it wasn't like, I must go back and I must change my country. It was after going there when I was like, oh my God, like, I'm so glad I'm here. You know, like that I can make this happen. I think I see a lot of young people staying to build their lives here. And I know so many young Pakistanis. Like, I gave a talk at Minerva last week, and there were these like really sweet students from Pakistan. And they were like, you know, we really want to do something, but we don't know how. And I think it's like, I really empathize with them, because it's like your life, you're building a life outside your home country. It demands everything of you. Like, with what time are you going to, or what energy are you going to invest back home, right? I've seen a lot of people, once they get a green card and feel like, okay, now I feel a bit more secure in this country, then like they think more about giving back. I know a lot of people give back by empowering change makers that are already working on ground through like their donations and mentorship. Is there a need for people? Oh, absolutely. I think the countries that have their graduates move back and build a country are very lucky. And I wish that we had more of like a pipeline of people being able to do that.
Thank you. Thank you for asking that extra question that wasn't on our segment, because I was curious to learn that. Yes. Well, let's talk about the Siegel Innovation Fellowship. It's a prestigious leadership and social impact fellowship that supports emerging change makers. And you were the inaugural fellow. What has that experience been like for you?
It was amazing. I actually have my photo of me and my students through the program I built, like right here. So, and I look at it often whenever I'm like, what's the meaning of this? And then I remember, oh my gosh, okay, I love my students. And I think of them. It was great. I received funding to build my own program that is going to help middle and high school students get more clarity about their future. That was like the broad ask that American Student Assistance had, the funders. So I created the Imagination Lab, which was a social entrepreneurship program for middle and high school students that had an immigrant background. Like, that piece is super important to me. And what I noticed, like, basically it was like design thinking, helping, like the boldness of it all was like, can we have immigrant students think about the problems in their own communities and think of become the change makers in that equation? And how can we activate them locally, right? And so consequently, the pilot was with Lawrence, Lawrence High School in Massachusetts. It's historically been like the lowest performing school districts in the entire state of Massachusetts. I worked with this amazing teacher, Maureen Santiago. I love her so much. And we had 20 students that were working in teams to solve a problem. And the end of it, they came to Harvard to actually pitch in front of a panel of judges that were world-class experts about their problems. And just to give you like the impact, because not everything can be captured in numbers. The first day when I came in, my students were like, oh, miss, like, do Latinos go to Harvard? And most of my students were from Dominican Republic, or like they were from Puerto Rico. Like a lot of them were Spanish speakers, right? To then like show up to Harvard, we did like a welcome video for them with people like saying their names, like, hi, Farida, like, bienvenidos, like, in Spanish, in English, really make them feel welcome. And like the last slide, like it was so sweet. Like I was telling my story and I started tearing up because I was so proud of my students and so proud of how the day went. My students, they all leapt from their seats and they all like ran up to me and engulfed me in a hug. And they were like, miss, it's okay to cry. We were crying too. Like, you know, you're doing important things. You're doing hard things. And I still have photos of like them engulfing me in a hug. I'm 5 foot and some of my students were like 5'10" and like, it's so cute, like those pictures. But that experience was amazing. It taught me about how difficult it is to be in a public school in the US, how challenging it is, how amazing the kids are, how well intentioned the teachers are. But it really, like, I really applaud Miss Santiago for like letting me be a part of her classroom. Because had she said like, no, the Imagination Lab would have remained a theory, but I got to go to the classroom and build a curriculum out. It is now being used in Massachusetts by like Lawrence High School. And there are other like schools that are also interested, and we're working with distribution actually with ASA this week. So if folks are interested in implementing this in their schools around the world, like you will actually have access to those resources for free.
That is amazing. So there are high school students that were in the Imagination Lab, right? So it's only for high school students. Are you going to adapt that for other ages or secondary schools?
I honestly think that it can be used as early as like 7th or 8th grade. I think 6th grade is a big year of transition in the US and around the world from elementary, like you're finding your feet in like your new middle school. But as early as 7th grade, like the curriculum is not that complex. And it was designed with the flexibility and fluidity to allow your teachers and facilitators to like really adjust for their audience in their classrooms.
Wow, that is tremendous impact. Okay, one more thing we have to talk about is Half the Story. That's another program that you're currently working in, right? As a learning designer, tell us a little bit more about who Half the Story serves and what are you doing?
Yeah. So Half the Story is a nonprofit that's focused on improving digital well-being in middle and high school students. We do a lot of program around youth activation. So we have summer programs called Digital Civics Academy that teens can be a part of. We have a teen tech council that kids can join if they care about how cell phones and screens are affecting their digital well-being. And then we also partner with schools across the US and hopefully in the future internationally. So I actually designed the curriculum that helps like build that awareness in students to put down their phones and their screens and be more present in their day-to-day lives, right? We believe screens are a tool and they can be great for making your life better. But what we're seeing is that screens are taking control of kids instead of kids controlling their screens. And it's not always helpful to have your mom tell you, get off your phone, right? Like you need to be able to build that muscle. So that's what I'm doing. And I talk to a lot of schools who are interested in digital wellness. So if you're like a teacher that wants to talk about digital wellness, like please reach out to me. But I think it's all for me, like in the same universe of capacity building for young people, like through Oran and VLP, it was capacity building through soft skills. In Imagination Lab, it was capacity building through entrepreneurship skills. And now it's like capacity building through like digital wellness and very core thing like screens. I really like kind of rid students of their agency in some ways.
I love that because yes, screens are robbing us of our attention and yes. Valuable time. Any tips for adults who are always doom scrolling? I mean, anything helpful for adults as well? That you could share.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the thing that helped me a lot was thinking about your screen time in terms of energy giving and energy stealing. I think we sometimes bucket all of our activities on screen as bad. But like for me, I realized like I really do like to wind down after work by doing something that's like low effort. Like sometimes I like to read a book, but sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, that's still like activating my brain. So I'm like, should I scroll on my phone versus watching half an episode of my favorite TV show? And I realized when I watch my favorite TV show, like something like Avatar, The Last Airbender, it energizes me. Versus when I'm on my phone scrolling, it really drains me. The same 15 minutes or 20 minutes, right? So think about things you're doing that bring you life and joy. And try to invest time in doing those versus like being on your phone just doom scrolling. I also think like this was like a big like aha moment for me, but it's like we kind of forget how much color and joy and emotion our screens elicit to us in ways that makes us feel like our life is not that interesting. And so actively seeking ways to have hobbies, meetups, gatherings in your day-to-day life, or in your like maybe something you do every week that makes you really excited. So instead of scrolling on Friday night, you're out biking or rollerblading or hosting dinner for your friends. It's about building a life where the default is not like, oh my gosh, I have nothing to do, so I want to be on my screen, right? So it's like, how can you build that muscle to make your life more attractive than your screens?
No, I think we all need to hear that. And it's not just for the kids, it's for all of us. Yeah, it's, I mean, for me, like, I absolutely do not like social media. I only allow myself very little time weekly to post on it. And otherwise, I see that more of as a resource, but not a place I'm going to spend time. Because, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a lot. Well, we're almost at the end. This has been such an insightful and inspiring conversation with you. And I'm learning so much about your work and learning design and all these amazing things you've done in the different communities. What would you say are some skills that one should have or one should cultivate if they want to get started on a career as a social entrepreneur, if they have a cause or a problem they want to fix and build something around that? What would you think is important for someone to get started who may not have the educational background, but is like, okay, I see a problem, I want to get started. How would they start?
Yeah, be a good listener. If there's a community you want to impact, you have to start by talking to them and asking them what their problems are before you jump into designing solutions. Like, if you don't know, like this framework called design thinking is really helpful for breaking down the process of making a prototype. Whatever idea you have, instead of making the perfect plan to execute it, just like do it, like actually go out there and do it. And iterate and make it better with time. Like the first classes of Young Leaders program at Uran were like so boring. And then my students were like, Miss, we fall asleep. Please, can you make them better? And then they got better and more interactive. And then the feedback from the last batch I taught were like, oh my gosh, this was so fun. We love it. Like blah, blah, blah. So it's like, really like be willing to jump in and make change happen and be consistent. Like, I think often change makers, like they do a one-off thing and they're just like, sorry, I just realized we won't have a video on the pie. So like, they're like, just like, why do my hands?
We can hear that. Yeah. No, it's true.
And they're like, okay, like, you know, khalas is their big word. Like, I'm done here. Like, I made that one-time donation. Like, they're like, find something you care about and actually like, be like, how can I show up this week? Or even if you decide, like, I'm going to dedicate like 2 hours a month to this, like, make sure you make those, set aside those 2 hours and keep showing up in that way. And build in public. Like, I think a lot of venture-backed companies are very good at talking about the work they do. Like, the founders post on Twitter and LinkedIn and like really talk about the work they're doing, and social entrepreneurs are like sort of cast to the side because we're like, oh, we're doing good work. Mm-hmm. Why should we promote it or talk about it? The world doesn't work that way anymore. Social proof is becoming really important. For me, I found a lot of speakers for YLP by posting stuff on LinkedIn, I found a lot of support and donors because I talked about it on LinkedIn almost every day for like 4 months. And so if you can find whatever work you're doing and talking about it in a community, like virtually, I've noticed you are more likely to deepen your impact and help the community better. So yeah, don't be shy. Like, I think especially women yes. are like very shy about like showing off, you know, like it's okay. Everybody gets to show off. Why shouldn't you? Like, you're doing good work.
Great advice. Building in public, talking about what you're doing, sharing it with others so people know that you're there and you're working on a project is, yeah, the algorithms help too. If you talk about it, if you use LinkedIn is great for that, for building. I'm going to ask you one last question for this final segment. What are some of your future goals? What else do you want to build going forward? Or is there a project that you wish to start or something you'd love to collaborate on in the future?
Yes. So there's a few things. I think my life's like long-term big goal is to scale YLP in a way that it can reach a lot of rural villages and a lot of like, you know, the places in Pakistan outside Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad, like the bigger cities, to start, create it as like a model that other developing economy countries can mirror for helping youth in their communities. I think for myself in the short term, and someone told me to be bold and ask for things, I'm going to ask for it, is I love public speaking and I love storytelling to talk about the issues that are so important. And so if anyone who's listening this would want to hear from me, I would love to be a speaker for you. I've spoken for Google in the past and it was amazing. I've spoken for like a lot of like other universities and schools, mostly in Pakistan, but some in the US. And I want to do that more because I think like most young people don't see social entrepreneurship as a viable career. They don't have enough role models that are talking about it. So if you're listening to this and you're like, hey, I actually have a magazine, a newspaper, or this panel that's coming up that we'd love Iza on, like, yeah, please reach out to me.
No, and then, absolutely.
And then like the last thing is, like, I am always, and I make this obvious on my LinkedIn. So in my head, it's like, of course, everybody knows this, but like, I am always looking for change makers in Pakistan. I love mentoring leaders and I love mentoring, especially like student activists. So if you are someone hearing this and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm actually working on a project and I'd love your advice or thoughts on what I'm doing, please reach out to me. I would love to mentor you, support you, and guide you and help amplify your work more. So those are my three asks.
Those are wonderful asks. And yes, I think the speaking part for sure. I mean, you have so many wonderful stories to share and all the work that you're doing right now. I'm looking forward to all these things flourishing even more for you.
Thank you.
What is something you've learned from your community that no classroom or textbook could teach you? And that's our reflective question. We always have that at the end of our episode. So what have you learned from your community that no classroom or textbook could teach you?
That's such a beautiful question. The power of happenstance and the surface area of opportunity. Some of the best things in my life have happened because I kept showing up to different conferences and speaker series, workshops, and talking to people. I talked to everyone that I possibly could. And so many amazing opportunities were born as a consequence. Like, you know, like even finding Minerva, like I wouldn't know about it because like it was such a young school when I applied. But had I not opened up to my mentor, had I not seen him in my break time and talked to him about like, hey, this is what I'm struggling with, you know, like an opportunity came back to me. And one of the most amazing internships I had is because I had Minerva's laptop sticker and I was sitting in a pitch competition in Seoul, South Korea. And this guy comes up to me and like gives me his email. He's like, yeah, I'd love to work with Minerva students and you know, turns out he's the CEO of like a multi-million-dollar gaming corporation called Deaf Sisters. And long story short, like that intro and relationship turned into like a lifelong mentorship. And he extended an internship opportunity for me to really like prototype their US office in San Francisco, hire interns myself. And that was 6 years ago. And today, like his daughter like studies in Berkeley, and I actually got to meet with her, take her out to dinner, like all these little things. But like, I keep thinking about Frida, like when you like, you know, like the more you show up to these places with like this openness in your heart and this willingness to be like, I will take what universe gives me today and honor it and follow up, like you will be amazed at how your life just like shifts, you know? Like often we go to these conferences and we just let our emails just like sit in like a notebook that we scribble them on and we don't follow up. And we're like, yeah, I had a great time. And then you have no idea who you met a year later. So you gotta like follow up. That's like part of like, you know, being open to the universe and this happenstance. So I guess it's not just one thing. It's a lot of different things. But I think that's like the reflection that's just really helped me.
No, I love that. And yes, you have to be in circulation, right? Like just like your body needs to circulate, you need to circulate. You need to put yourself out there. You need to be visible. And be prepared to meet people. Exactly. And that's how wonderful dots get connected, right? Well, exactly. This, you're right. Just nurture those connections as well. Good follow-up is very important also in every business. Well, your call to action says, you're always seeking like-minded educators and change makers from around the world. So we will link all your information and contact information in our episode guide so that people can reach out to Iza Navid, also on LinkedIn. I want to thank you for joining us. This was a very insightful conversation, and I hope that we can follow up on all your amazing works a little bit later in the future. But thank you for being such an active change maker, Iza. It was a delight to have you on.
Thank you so much, Farida. It was an honor to be here and to be included. Really, like, thank you. And to anyone listening, like, please reach out to me. Don't be shy. Practice that happenstance. And I look forward to hearing from you all.
Thank you. I am Farida. This is a Slow Dive. Till next time, remember to listen, reflect, and connect.
Thanks for listening to the Slow Dive. Please be sure to subscribe and give us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq and edited by Drew Franzblau. Our theme music is Dive by Ciro.